I know you're probably thinking of them in terms of your own individual performance in the class. And as I said before, if you get 3 out of 4 questions on a particular day, you're doing fine. Because these all get curved and placed within a grade range of A to B minus. And so generally, you know, people who are getting 3/4 or more tend to curve up into the B, B plus range. So that's not such a bad thing. That you should still try to get them all right, of course. The second thing I want to tell you, well, actually 3 things, I guess. You know, you might think of this just in terms of your individual performance, but from my perspective as a visual philosophy coach, you're really holding each other accountable also to coming to class prepared, because your ability to do philosophy is actually affected adversely if you get into small groups with people who haven't read carefully. Your ability to do philosophy depends upon a depth of reflective knowledge that I'm always challenging myself as a philosopher to read more carefully. If I read with other people, I notice that other people sometimes get a lot more out of the reading than I do. I'm not a great reader. Some of you may not be maybe fantastic readers. This is just going to be really easy. Others of you may, you might be like me. You might be I'm kind of a quick reader. I like to gloss over things sometimes. So, but trying to be a good philosopher, I know one of the things about my own challenge in being a good philosopher is that I need to put more energy into that. Especially when I'm with other people who have read more carefully, I realize I'm a free rider. I'm getting a free ride from them. So the point is that it's about group accountability as well as individual performance. Just like if we were doing a sport and you all showed up having done or not done some training, you know, we might say, well, you're letting yourself down because you're not going to perform as well at the sport if you don't do your training. But you know, we're also just not going to get as good as a group at this activity. And philosophy has that dimension. I'm a better philosopher partly because I put myself into communication with better philosophers than me. And partly because I can sometimes spot people who aren't doing as good a job at it as me, and I can benefit from that. So small group is one of the places that happens. So think of it as a collective responsibility to accountability. The other thing I wanted to mention, a very practical thing about excused absences in the quizzes. I have a very generous policy about excused absences. If you're sick, you don't need a note. If you're representing the university in any capacity, if you have a family event, if a friend calls you and they just need you, that's an excused absence. Okay, so I don't really need to. So those are all reasons for excuse. You do need to let me know that you missed for an excused reason. Otherwise, you would get a 0, right? And so you know, I'm relying on your honesty. Obviously, you could it'd be hard to oversleep this class, actually. That would be an achievement. But, you know, you could just, like, oversleep the class and say, oh, I had to help a friend who needed to go to the airport. And I'm not going to ask any questions about that, but try to be honest about these things. Come to class prepared. When something comes up, I'll give you an excused absence. And what I'll do is those points won't be in your total, so your percentage going into the curve, your percentage won't be based on 4 points, say, from today. Downside of a lot of excused absences is your score depends on very few things. Miss a lot of class, so try not to do that. Okay. Any questions about the mechanics of this? Okay. All right. Okay, let's get into our material today. I hope you're working out some way to bring the readings to class, either electronically on a screen. Maybe I can convince some of you to print PDFs. I don't know, but it is helpful to have access to these readings because we're gonna. I want you to be coming up with stuff while in response to the things I'm telling you. Okay, so let's just start with a real simple continuum between subjective and objective theories. And let's add some, this will allow us to review a little bit from last class and then add a lot of new detail. And last class we ran into classical Greek philosophers, including Plato and Aristotle. Let's use Aristotle as our poster child for a really robust, sometimes you'd call it, we would say it's a thick objective view, sometimes we would say it's an extreme view. And this would be, on this end of the spectrum, we'd be talking about a kind of thick subjective view. So what made Aristotle an objectivist? Does anybody remember? He believed that happiness depended upon realizing objective conditions in the world. And the cool phrase we had last Thursday, maybe it's in your notes, maybe you can flip back to it, is that to become happy, you need to become the kind of thing you are, right? So Aristotle has this idea that you have a nature, it unfolds through your life, and happiness is a kind of, remember, there's happiness is what we strive for, it, and our telos is what we're oriented toward. So there's a happy coincidence, no pun intended, between our telos as a creature, right, which is to develop our rational faculties, and the word that we use to describe what we are striving for, happiness. Now, I didn't, let's just look at a couple features of this view, because one thing you'll notice about this view is that happiness is unitary. And I just want to kind of give you a gloss on that. Classical Greek philosophers tended to think that if something had an essence, if something was, I'll give you the syllogism here. If something's real, it has an essence. And if something has an essence, it's one thing. If something's composite, then you haven't found the essence yet. Right? So I'll say it again. If something's real, it has an essence. And if it has an essence, that has to be one thing. An essential characteristic is the one thing that makes something the way it is. So a wooden chair is a composite thing. It's a composite of wood and the design of a chair. It has two essences. So if happiness is a real thing, it's got one essence. And that's part of the reason that classical Greek philosophers thought that it had to be reason. But we come up, you know, we live in a post-enlightenment, post-scientific revolution world, and one of the things we notice is that nature creates things in bundles. So nature tends to create, you know, a bunch of animals that look like, that are mammals, that, you know, walk on, bear their young lives, walk on all fours or 2 feet. Nature creates in groups and bundles and in variation. It's very hard in nature to figure out where you encounter an essence, right? I mean, at what point in our evolution did we become essentially human? For Aristotle, for Plato, we didn't evolve. So humans were always this way. We've always had this essential attribute of reason. So the world view, the model is kind of different there. And you remember in our work last time, we had a kind of alternative to Aristotle. So let's get that on our continuum. The alternative was a kind of list or set view of happiness. Does anybody remember that from our notes? Can you flip back to that? We wrote the curly brackets in there. Maybe you put them in your notes. What was that idea? Does anybody remember that? Instead of happiness being one thing that reflects your nature, this is an objective view where happiness could involve pursuing one or more of a variety of lives. So you could be happy because you developed your talents, that's one item in the set. You could be happy because you were a good friend and parent, sibling, you know, you were there for others. You could be happy because you devoted yourself to your community. You'd be happy because you cultivated some internal practices that put you in a really great state of mind most of the time. So this was a list and set, some of which could be sufficient, but none of them, and it depends on how you want to think about it, but none of them are necessary. In other words, the big difference between Aristotle is that this is a necessary and the pursuit of reason and the successful pursuit of your rational faculties is a necessary and sufficient condition for happiness for Aristotle. Remember, it's unitary, it's one thing. Now, in these other objective theories, list or set theories of happiness, you know, happiness is a set of things. It's an open question if any of them are necessary. Maybe none of them are. It's an open question whether any of them are sufficient. Maybe you have to have more than one to be happy. Those are all open questions. have questions about this? see what we're trying to do? Let's develop the continuum from the other side a little bit. Vitrano makes the point that happiness for a subjectivist is desire satisfaction. And, you know, in this article, let me point out, she doesn't really make a big deal out of it. She thinks subjective theories are better than objective theories. Let's make sure we get her reason for that at the end. I like the article because it just opens up more possibilities. And early on in the course, I feel like there's a basic issue that helps orient your theory of happiness. You know, you're going to be reflecting on this, I hope, over the semester. But this just opens up a lot of possibilities for you to consider. So coming from the subjective side, if you know, you could be like the Aristotle of the other end of the continuum and say, yep, desire satisfaction is what happiness is, and self reports of happiness are incorrigible. Let's get that phrase in your nose. Got a fancy word in it, incorrigible. Means cannot be called into doubt. For a true subjectivist about happiness, if you say you're happy, I don't have any other basis for knowing that. And so I have no way to call it into doubt. Okay? Can we think about this together a little bit? Can you think of anything else that's like that? Where, you know, the person's self-report is incorrigible?
Taste of food.
Yeah. And my favorite example is favorite flavors of ice cream. So you say, what's your favorite flavor of ice cream?
Mint.
No, it isn't. Wouldn't that be a weird thing to say? Like, how would I know? Like, how would I have any basis of challenging? Now, you could come up with it and elaborate. I happen to know she's lying. Right, because I've heard her talk to other friends over a long period of time, and it's not mint. It's Jamocha almond fudge, which is actually the correct answer for everyone.
Kind of a real-life example I think of is, like, if you ever have siblings, and, like, one of you hurts the other one, it's like, that hurt. It's like, no, it didn't. Like,
that's right. Yeah, really young siblings are willing to go where no epistemologist would go with confidence. Epistemologists are people who study the grounds of knowledge. What's my basis for knowing something? And anything objective, my basis for knowing it is going to probably involve multiple measures, right? If something's real, there's at least one way to get at it, probably, maybe. But if something's objective, don't use the words right. But if something's purely subjective, one characteristic we might have for it is that, you know, you can't really doubt or call into question a person's self-report. Does happiness sound like that? I mean, just as we were skeptical about Aristotle's unitary, rather extreme identification of happiness as the life of the philosopher, not that it has to be a successful philosopher, too. Can we also call into doubt this extreme a little bit? Or what sounds right about it, too? Let's do both. What sounds right about it?
I think it's good in the moment. First, we talk about state happiness versus life happiness.
Mm-hmm.
I feel happy.
Yeah, and I tend, and in the moment, we tend not to doubt people's reports.
Mm-hmm.
But that could partly be because their reports coincide with our observations, right? We're going to run into happiness research where we ask people about their own happiness, and then we ask their friends, how happy is she? If there's a high level of correlation there, that gives us a little bit of confidence that we might be measuring the same thing. Anybody else? Reasons to doubt it? So one reason to be in favor of it is, in practice, we do this, and we tend not to doubt it. Anybody? Can you think of an example where we do doubt the person?
It's like they're being potentially happier. So I think they're happy where they are, but they like I just know, I really like chocolate. Well, if you're trying mint, you like it way better.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, we tend to be thinking of this as happy versus unhappy as a kind of bivalent thing, like a switch. But happy versus happier, that opens up a whole lot of possibilities. So now somebody could say, wow, I'm really happy. I had a great dinner last night and a great friend. And you could come back to them and say, well, you know, you could be happier, right? So you might not call into doubt their report, but you could raise a question about whether their report is a final report. Yeah, others. Yeah, you had something there, too.
I was just thinking of someone denial about, like an addiction or something, where people
right.
say, like, I am really happy where I'm at.
Yeah.
Like, I think about eating disorders, like,
yeah.
like, I'm happy with my body.
Yeah, I mean, we do, I'm not sure I believe that self-reports of happiness are incorrigible. I think sometimes I can raise reasonable doubts about someone's reported happiness. She gave us good examples there. Addiction, depression, things people, states that people aren't aware they're in. You could think you're happy and you're not. Right? I mean, the experience machine was an example that most of us, I think, agree would be a case where if someone said they were happy on the experience machine, we might call that into question. Is that real happiness? So when you're moving from the subjective side, so you might want some options in here because you might like the subjective response, but you might want to make it stronger by nuancing it a little bit. So let me remind you of some things from the article. We're really in the article around page, just in the second page, third page. So you might say that it's not just desire satisfaction, but it's important desire. Right? You know, somebody says, hey, I'm happy. Look, I can always satisfy my desire for ice cream sandwiches. I like really cheap ice cream sandwiches. I get plenty of them. I'm happy. Whoa, that's a weird thing to say. Those are kind of trivial desires. Desire for ice cream sandwiches. Come on. Do you guys like a good ice cream sandwich? I do. Ice cream sandwiches will become a metaphor in the course for a lot of things, including for ice cream sandwiches. Because sometimes an ice cream sandwich is just an ice cream sandwich. It's a trivial desire. So if you're trying to say, I'm happy because I have lots of ice cream sandwiches, someone might come back and say, well, no, it has to be important desires. You might say it has to be important desires that are also worthwhile. Right? So you have another position there. You don't need to learn the names of these. You might say that you have to realize your goals. I will associate a name with this because she's kind of a famous philosopher, Julia Annis. She's a famous Aristotelian philosopher, so her view might actually be closer to Aristotle than I'm putting it. But she basically says you have to have goals and achievements. So she's not like Aristotle in the sense that there's only one kind of goal or achievement you have to have, but she's definitely not like a subjectivist because she doesn't think it's just desire satisfaction. You have to have desires, they have to be important and worthwhile, they have to lead to goals and achievements. Let's stop on this for a second. I want to see if I can get some good philosophy out of you here. What sounds right and wrong about the idea that happiness has to involve achievements? What sounds, start either right or wrong. What sounds right about it or wrong about it? Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, like, someone can achieve pretty terrible things.
Right. So you might want to say they have to be worthwhile achievements. Can you be, by the way, we have to talk about this morality and happiness connection. So yeah, good. That's a good one to get on board. Yeah, other one. Yeah, thank you.
People consider like vastly different things achievements, and like
maybe
the academic.
Yeah, I mean, you're right to wonder about that. I'm coming from this side of the scale. I'm kind of picking up these criteria as well. So I'm thinking she has in mind important and worthwhile achievements, things appropriate to a human. So so I think that's a really good thing to bring in here. They have to be, there's a wide variety of achievements, and I don't think it's just anything goes once you're at this point in the spectrum, right? If you're just here, maybe, right? Good, yeah.
I think happiness and validation go hand in hand. Like, it doesn't have to be somebody telling you, oh, you did a great job, but we might like the benefit of getting a good grade in a class, and that is the validation for our hard work, which then gives us happiness in return.
It could be that it's not the particular goals that you're achieving, but that you're getting validation for achieving anything.
Yeah,
I hear that. I think that's really an interesting possibility.
I think some people might not be very good at achieving things, so that would be kind of implying that they can't be happy.
Yeah, that's a reason for doubting achievement. As a remember Patton Lee, right? Lee was plausibly happy, but he wasn't achievement oriented. Let's just say it that way. Nice guy, not ambitious.
And kind of off of that, you could have people that have achievements and they're still not happy.
Good, very good. Another source of counterexamples. There must be something else. This isn't a sufficient criteria. My two cents is, you know, along the same lines as what you guys are saying, is a slightly different consideration, but similar kind of consideration. I'm dubious of this. I think I agree with it because I do think that there's something about the structure of our nature that's oriented toward goals and achievements, and I think we definitely get satisfaction from that. So that, to that extent, I'm kind of in agreement, but I feel the counterexample of Lee, the person who doesn't, who is happy, and I would judge happy, but isn't a goal achievement oriented person. But my objection today, I just thought about it this morning, I was just kind of coming back to this. This is a funny thing to make a criterion out of, because in my experience, it's likely that people can make themselves happy even if they don't achieve the goals they set out to achieve. So goal achievement seems like the wrong criteria, because we very often wind up achieving different goals than we set out to achieve. So if you can only be happy if you achieve the goals you set out to achieve, which is a specific interpretation I'm making of your point, then that seems false, because it seems like we have lots of cases, in fact it's the typical case, I would say, in which a person is happy in spite of not having achieved the exact goals they set out to achieve, or discovering in the process of achieving those goals that some other goals look pretty good. So goal achievement sounds very objective and stable when you say it this way. I mean, as your parents were raising you, you know, they were probably encouraging you to think about your goals and what kind of things you're good at, what are you motivated by, right? So that language sounds right. It just seems like if you understand it too literally, it's implausible. Does that make sense? Because a lot happens between the goal setting and the achievement. So there's reasons to kind of move away from the extremes, but there's also problems for any position in the middle here. Okay. So you might think that Julia's position would be better if achievement was just one of the items in the list. You see? And maybe actually we should have flipped these two. Okay. All right, let's get to our thought experiment, which gives us a really good chance to do some philosophy in small groups. And today I think we have a good opportunity on this. On the thought experiment about Jane. Can somebody remind us about Jane? What was the story? What was the issue with Jane?
Yeah. I think this is her. She was the one that believed that she had a really happy life, but her husband was cheating on her, having an affair, and she didn't realize it. So she still believed that her life was perfect and that she was happy, but objectively people would say she's not happy because her life isn't actually as perfect as she seems, but subjectively you can still say that she is happy because she's ignorant to the fact that her husband is cheating.
Yeah. So Jane poses a thought experiment. Jane's a fictional person who seems happy because she's happy about her, in part because she's happy about her relationship. She's invested in that for her happiness, but she's deceived about that. And Vetrano, this is an important point for your notes, Vetrano thinks the Jane thought experiment is evidence against objectivist theories, right? Because she thinks we would call Jane happy because she has the subjective experience of desire satisfaction. Now, What I'd like you to do in small groups is actually take on the thought experiment. Oh, you know, introduce yourselves, see who you're talking to, face each other. Take on the thought experiment and consider more possibilities than that Jane either is or isn't happy. Let's try to complicate this. It's more complicated than that. How do you make sense of the competing intuition? So thought experiments often trigger competing intuition. On the one hand, Jane seems happy. She's described as a happy person. On the other hand, we tend to be suspicious of people's reports. We tend to be reluctant to call people happy if they're fundamentally deceived. And remember, the experience machine is the big example of that. Absolute deception about your happiness. Most of you were willing to say that's not happiness. Okay? So absolute deception would be the Jane thought experiment is a tiny bit of deception, or maybe not a tiny bit. Okay, so in your groups, try to assess the thought experiment. Try to consider other possibilities besides just that Jane's really happy, not happy, and see what that involves committing yourself to if you raise the possibilities. Okay, form groups spontaneously. Introduce yourselves. Turn your chairs. Face each other. Try to ask questions. Try to do philosophy. Take some notes. Come with stuff to report back. When you were in your groups, did you ask a question? Did you help clarify somebody's view? Did you try to express your view clearly? Probably many of you did the third thing more than the first two. Consider a variety of activities that you can engage in to be a good philosopher with others. A lot of it has to do with helping. Socrates had this wonderful metaphor that the philosophy is about helping to deliver the other person's philosophical theory as if it were a baby. So he said philosophers are like midwives. Which is a remarkable metaphor for a male-dominated culture to come up with, frankly. But try to deliver each other's ideas as if they were babies. Don't get carried away with the metaphor then. Okay, so what came out of the groups? What do you have to bring back that you could report as an interesting consideration, an interesting argument, an interesting idea that you heard? What do you think? What do I say about Jane?
When judging someone else's happiness, you can't really use facts that they aren't aware of or ideas that they aren't aware of because it's their happiness and that's kind of an isolated little.
I like that. So
area.
you're kind of putting that out as a principle. Like,
yeah.
Maybe that's a principle about happiness judgment. Mm-hmm.
That was just kind of.
Can you think? I think that's neat that came out in your group. Can you think of a reason why that might be true? I mean, the Jane case makes you think. Right.
I mean, it's just more that it's like her happiness, and I'm not going to tell her whether she's happy or not. I mean, even if I know about the cheating husband or what.
Let me try your thesis a slightly different formulation. If this is a little more elaborate, but if our happiness depends on what we don't know, then maybe nobody's happy. I mean, maybe the reason we shouldn't make judgments of happiness dependent on what people don't know about themselves is that would make it hard to say that anyone's happy. But anyway, good start. Yeah, thanks.
Well, I'm just going to play devil's advocate
sure.
to that and say, like, maybe someone's happiness could also depend on how they deal with change and new information.
Right.
So, like, you know, maybe Jane would be totally devastated in her life, would be blown apart if she found out, but maybe
right. She
would accept it, put it aside, and be thankful for whatever else is in her life.
Right, or maybe she would, maybe all of the above, maybe she would have a range of reactions,
right.
But
right.
In the end, she might decide that she was better off knowing, and she might decide that she can make herself happier now, dealing with that information, right. So let's see, his point is interesting, or his group's point was that you shouldn't always assess happiness by the conditions, but by people's capacities to respond to conditions, right? We've been thinking, well, happiness is about being, enjoying, truthfully enjoying certain conditions, or, you know, those conditions being true. And that's certainly relevant, but happiness can also depend on how our capacities for responding, our competencies. Good. Yeah. These are good results. Good. What else?
Yeah, Duke. I mean, I was just going back to that. Like, I wasn't saying that her finding out wouldn't change her happiness, but more of you have to look at it at what she knows at the time, and then that will definitely change as she finds out more information. I mean, it's definitely kind of a time.
Yeah, I like your point. It came up last class, and the way we summarize it is we're all Jane.
Yeah.
I mean, we're kind of all Jane. Now, we're not all in relationships with husbands cheating on us, but my point is, we all enjoy a kind of happiness which could be not compromised, that's too strong, but could be disrupted by becoming aware of certain things that we might prefer not to become aware of. For instance, you might be happy partly because you think you're a really good lover. Well, you know, I mean, how much do you want to know about that? you could be happy for a lot of reasons where the objective basis for that, you could think that I could be happy partly because I think I'm a really good philosopher. It could be everybody's just kind of nice to me about it. Don't tell Alfie, though. He thinks he's really good at this. Yeah. Yeah, so we're all Jane. In some ways, if we can judge someone not happy because they didn't know something that would have compromised their illusion of happiness, well, okay, maybe that does sound plausible, but that puts all of us in that boat to some extent. Now, you could say, no, we're not all Jane. If you're deluded about something really big and important like that, assuming it was big and important to her, right, then that's not like the general condition of being Jane. We're also assuming that it's important to her. You know, somebody in the other class said, well, what if she did learn, and she said to her husband, yeah, bud, you want to know what I've been up to? In other words, we could be wrong in thinking that it matters to her.
Right.
So does that make it dependent upon risk? So
what?
When you marry someone, you're attaching your life to someone else's. There's more inherent risk.
I think you've hit on an insight that we need to pause on for just a moment here. I think it is definitely true that if you get committed to a relationship, deep relationship with someone, whether it's marriage or not, you are putting your happiness at risk. But it's like a lot of gambles. Maybe it's a risk worth taking, right? Because you have to evaluate the risk to your happiness of being in the relationship and the risk to your happiness of avoiding relationships. Somewhere in between, there's the relationships you should or shouldn't have. So good. This is good stuff. Other stuff from your groups? Notice we're coming up with ways of complicating Jane's situation. Partly because maybe, like your principle, which I like, maybe this just isn't the right... Maybe that's not a consideration you should include when you assess someone's happiness. It's just... My analysis was a little bit, well, similar to what you guys are saying. So you went into your groups with these two possibilities. Jane's happiness is an illusion. Jane was happy. And I thought there were at least two other possibilities. One is that we could say that Jane did experience happiness. I don't think I'm inclined to deny that she experienced happiness as a subjective state. I think you could also say that Jane's happiness was flawed, at least flawed on her own criteria, by her own criteria. Notice you could say it's flawed because every human being ought to be in a monogamous relationship. I don't know what kind of objective theory, that's not even Aristotle. But you could also say it's flawed subjectively because based on her own subjective criteria, she thought her happiness involved being in a faithful monogamous relationship. But my point would be that when you make these two judgments, and this might be similar to your group's point, these look like similar judgments about Jane's situation, but in fact, do you see a difference between the standpoint from which you make this judgment versus this judgment? Can we just take a minute? Maybe you see this. Maybe I'm making this up. I don't know. Are these really? They're both judgments about Jane's happiness, but are they really similar judgments? Where are you standing when you make this judgment versus here?
Well, I think like the third one's a little bit more objective.
Yeah, you're kind of standing outside of everybody's life. You're standing, you're examining what makes someone's happiness flawed. Well, they might die young, their husband might cheat on them, right? They may never achieve anything in their career, and it matters to them. So here you're taking a kind of third-person perspective. And it's really a kind of outside of time. You're taking a kind of universalist perspective here to make this judgment. And all things in general, this was a flawed sort of happiness. And if I'm judging her life and her happiness by her own criteria against others by their own criteria, right? Then we could say that hers was flawed. But when you say that, you're standing outside of her life. Whereas if you wanted to make a judgment, and I think that's a legitimate judgment to make, I think I would like to be able to stand outside of my life sometimes and ask really deep questions about whether there are defects in the kind of happiness I'm experiencing, right? And self-deception is one of the places to look, right? Philosophers are supposed to be dedicated to rooting out self-deception in their lives. On the other hand, I think I could still make this judgment about myself or Jane. And when I make this judgment, I'm not in the third-person perspective. I'm kind of taking Jane's life from her perspective, from her first-person perspective, right? You know what I mean by first-person, third-person? Remember from your grammar lessons, right? You share it, right? So really, I mean, I think for my analysis, you know, you can say both that Jane experienced happiness and that Jane's happiness was flawed, but you're making different kinds of judgments. You're standing in a different place. Does that make sense? I see some puzzled looks. It's okay. If I were in your small group, you'd just help me clarify.
So couldn't you almost say she was like, hooked up to like the happiness machine then? Like, in a way, it's kind of the same thing, because like, if she knew everything, she wouldn't be happy, but with this ignorance, with ignorance being the happiness machine, then she is happy.
Yeah, I like where you're going with that. You know, there's a theorist who says something similar. He says, hey, we're going to read Gilbert in the course. He says, we respond to our own ideas of happiness. So part of the reason it would be a problem for Jane to find out that her husband cheated on her is that she had an ideology of her own happiness, which included faithful husbands, right? Another person might have had an idea about relationships which just didn't put that much weight on that.
So you're saying like her own objective ideas kind of create her happiness, or what are keeping her from being unhappy?
Her own subjective ideas, her own ideas that are unique to her subjectivity. There might be other people who have similar ideas, but she's appropriated them uniquely as a subjective act. She grew up in a certain culture, which encouraged her to believe that, you know, faithful marriage is key to happiness, the key to raising families. Those could all be very reasonable beliefs, but sometimes people, the other way to put the point is, sometimes people are miserable because they fail to live up to the happiness ideology that they've taken on, right? Every year you get a few freshman advisees who want to become doctors because their parents and relatives want them to become doctors, right? They took on this idea that this is what's going to make them happy. Maybe it works out, maybe it doesn't work out. So can we use this phrase, happiness ideology? It could be like the ideas you formed about what's essential to you. Okay, other thoughts on this? Where there's another direction to go if we're done with this. I hope you're seeing the method here. You know, you've got a thought experiment here which prompts you, in this case, to come up with an analysis, you have competing intuitions, and you have to come up with an analysis and, of what we should say about Jane, and so that's an example of a result as well. Okay. All right, let's shift gears a little bit. We got some interesting stuff in the Habern chapter. Let's kind of turn to that, and I just want to pick out a couple of things, and then we'll be wrapping things up. So this is a really short chapter. He's just getting us started, and he wants to pick out a couple of remarkable facts. He says a remarkable fact. There's actually several remarkable facts. Let's start our notes here, right? One thing you learn in this chapter is that really poor people are a lot happier than you would predict them to be. Can you get that in your notes? Really poor people are a lot happier than you would predict them to be. Let's just think about that together. I mean, to the extent that happiness has objective features, you'd expect it to have similar effects in different places, right? If I told you were going to start living in absolute poverty, I would expect it to have a pretty big negative impact on your reported happiness. I've been to cultures in absolute poverty. I mean, how many of you have traveled to cultures that experienced absolute poverty? It's hard for me to imagine the numbers, the reports, the research we get from the bottom billion in the world. They're a lot happier than they ought to be. I'm joking. They're a lot happier than I would predict that they would be. So that's a remarkable fact. And when you're theorizing about happiness, remember, your 15-week project is to come up with your own theory of happiness. What must happiness be like if that's true? That's kind of, I want you to theorize distinctive facts and features of the problem. That's a very distinctive feature of happiness problem. Any ideas? Yeah. What must happiness be like if that's true?
Possibly not based upon material possessions and circumstances.
Yeah, certainly, just because you can't imagine being happy without living in absolute wealth, it doesn't follow that it's true. Now, you always have the option of saying, well, those bottom billion folks who say they're happy, they're wrong. you can't do that. But they're pretty persuasive. They smile a lot. And they say things about their experience that suggest that they are happy. I love my family. I'm just so glad things aren't worse. God. I mean, I've heard people say that in really dire circumstances. What else might or must be true about happiness if this fact is true? Yeah.
Depending on expectation.
Yeah, happiness might have a kind of relativity to expectations and circumstances. Yeah.
They take like satisfaction from the things that we overlook on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, we might be missing things that they're seeing. Yeah, very good. We could be. It could turn the lesson on us. We could think we're happy and we could think we're happy because we have X, Y, and Z, late model cars. Nice restaurants to go to, you know. But we could be wrong about that.
Yeah. Or it could just be conditioned and habitual to, they never
right.
do anything else, or the same way that maybe going fishing makes me happy and you reading a book makes you happy.
Yeah.
It's just two different ways of thinking about it.
Yeah. Could be human society is just condition each other. In human society, we condition each other to say, how you doing? Fine. You know? It could be that that's just a trained response in human communities. And so it happens whether you're living close to the dirt or not.
Yeah.
Others? These are good.
I think on the flip side, too, there might be things in our like materialistic world that we live in that make us unhappy.
Yeah.
Like more stress. Yeah.
So we often make that judgment when we look at people who are happy without those things. The other remarkable fact in this chapter is the enormous cultural variation in happiness. And this group, the Pidana, I don't know why it's spelled so differently than it's said, but the Pidana are these people who are also in the bottom billion, and yet they have a huge ratio of positive affect to negative affect. they are really happy people. Every researcher who meets the Padana says, oh my God, I can't believe how happy these people are. They don't worry, they don't have anxieties. You tell them a story about suicide, they can't even get the point. You know, that's somebody who's really kind of out there. So this isn't just happy in spite of being poor. It is true that the Padana are poor. They're a lot happier than the other poor people. In other words, putting it this way, cultures create matrices of happiness. No, that's not, I don't like that word. Wait a minute. Cultures create models of happiness. Cultures create and reproduce. That's the cool thing about culture, is that it reproduces itself through child rearing and reproduction. Cultures create and reproduce different models of happiness. In some cultures, we're going to read more literature on this. This is just a taste. In some cultures, children are encouraged to express negative affect. In other cultures, they are discouraged. In some cultures, children are encouraged to be boisterous in expressing positive affect. Cultures have different ratios of positive and negative affect, as if there was something in that culture that kind of said, this is how it's okay to experience affect.
I also think that with our society as we have it now, it's very competitive. But if you look at other societies like that, it's more like, I'm happy if you're happy, that type of nature.
Right, right.
And then in that sense, you're going to have less negative effects because you're not being placed up against the people around you.
Good. I like that. And that kind of adds a little bit more of the dark side of this, which is that we enforce happiness models against each other. We tell each other what, in this culture, you shouldn't be happy being a slacker. We have a word for people like you. Slackers. You should be happy achieving. Right? You know, so the cultures have these ideologies or views of happiness that we kind of enforce against each other. After all, we're choosing each other for relationships. There's a lot that comes in, a lot of our happiness thinking comes into play. Is this somebody that I can be happy with? Well, how are they pursuing happiness? Do they fit my model for pursuing happiness? Other? You got other comments? Yeah, please.
There's a comment. I thought it was interesting how figures in this society, they asked how to measure people, like, their happiness level, and they said, like, the amount of time they spend smiling and laughing,
right.
Which is, like, an interesting thought for us, but also the different forms of happiness can feel, like peace, but you're not, like, necessarily smiling, but it's still, like, a form of happiness, so within that, there's just so many different ways to...
Good point. You're noticing that we're thinking about positive and negative affect kind of simplistically, right? Like it's all one scale. But in fact, affect is qualitatively diverse. There's ecstasy and contentment. Those are both forms of positive affect. So we're going to do some work on it. Absolutely. Yeah, we're going to get a little more of a vocabulary of affect because we don't want to just flatten everything down to one scale, positive, negative. I mean, I like to make continuums, as you can tell, but those can be oversimplifications. Good. Okay, one more thing, and then we'll be ready to go. Let's just do this really well. Comes up at the end of the chapter. It's a little bit of a hard question for you guys, but it's a really basic distinction, and it's the distinction between Habermas's theory of happiness and the theory of happiness that I guess I got focused on in my studies of happiness. So I just want to highlight this. If you could draw this in your notes, this is Habermas. And a lot of theorists are like Habermas here. They're basically saying happiness is, get this in your notes, it's a psychological state. It's a state of mind. It's a psychological condition. Let me see if there's some other word he uses for it. No, that's pretty much it. Whereas, so this is state happiness, right? How are you feeling? Scale of 1 to 10. This is life happiness. On all things being equal, how is your life going? Are you happy with how your life is going? So these are theories of happiness that involve well-being or value notions. To answer this state happiness question, you don't have to ask a complicated question. You say, how happy, on a scale of 1 to 10, how happy are you right now? And that's a lot of happiness research is done that way, right? It's done by surveys that ask people about their states of affect right now. And here, I just want to put in a couple of considerations. Okay, Habermann's reason for limiting happiness to state happiness is that it's too complicated to consider these other things. This is life happiness is really a different question. My reason for still preferring, so that's his reason, that happiness seems to be the simplest way to study it seems to be as a psychological state. And I think he's got a good point there. I kind of buy that. I'm not persuaded because maybe I just got rooted in my bias, but the reason I like this composite model of happiness is because I think there are a lot of interesting interactions between state and life happiness. So I don't feel comfortable theorizing state happiness apart from life happiness, even though I acknowledge these are really different. This is a report of affect. This is like, how am I feeling right now? Direct introspection. This is a judgment. This is complicated. So it kind of makes sense to keep this out of the picture, but what if you think there really are a lot of connections between how happy you're going to wind up in your life and how and your competencies in managing emotional states? Are those things connected or separate, do you think? I'm suggesting they're connected. Yeah, you have a hunch?
Yeah, well, I think, like, you have a friend that died or something. You're really sad for the moment, but lifeline happiness, the potential be sad and gave you that potential happiness be place to love something.
Yeah.
You'd be really sad if you just focus on your current happiness and it's stoic. Oh,
that's a good example.
I'm not sad, but I'm not really that.
Yeah. In a way, focusing on state happiness without thinking about the deeper things in life, like losing friends, having friends, losing friends, it feels like you're focusing on the effects rather than some of the deeper causes. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it's a reasonable question to ask, can your life be richer and happier because you have loved and lost friends? And I think if you just ask about momentary time slices, you just get values, you just get numbers, you know. Oh, that was really horrible today. Oh my gosh, really? Is that true? Oh, I won lottery. Wow, that's fantastic. Okay, but those dots don't really have a lot of meaning without knowing what's driving them. Those values, those psychological states. And so for me, this is a more holistic and complete way to look at things because I want to know about these connections. Good example. Anybody have another example about how state and life happiness might be connected? In case, we're going to hear Habermann's case. It's better to, methodologically, he's probably on slightly stronger ground. That it's better to take this part away and just try to analyze it. But we'll see. That's an ongoing thing in the discussion. Okay, let's break there. See you guys on Thursday. Hope everything's going well. Please contact me if there's anything that's not going well or you have questions about the class.